The Romanesque Cathedral of Saint-Étienne would no longer do. Though it had been expanded several times to accommodate the ever-growing population of Paris, Bishop Maurice de Sully made the call. The cathedral was to be torn down, its materials recycled, and a new cathedral was to take its place. Much bigger, much grander, it was to become a fitting home for the bustling city of Paris. Welcome to the Beauty Ever New podcast. The ceremony was an august occasion, April 1163 AD. His Majesty King Louis VII was looking on as people took their place. The people of Paris showed up in droves. His Holiness Pope Alexander III blessed the workers as they laid the cornerstone of what would become Notre Dame Cathedral. What followed was four phases of construction, which saw radical innovation in construction and the arts. Magnificent height culminating in beautiful curving vaults. Stained glass windows, stories tall, enabled by the advent of the flying buttress, and breathtaking sculptures depicting salvation history. By 1260, the cathedral was largely finished, though modifications continued over the next several centuries. In 1303, a stunned John of Jandon, coming upon the majestic cathedral, wrote, "That most glorious church of the most glorious Virgin Mary, Mother of God, deservedly shines out like the sun among stars. And although some speakers, by their own free judgment, because able to see only a few things easily, may say that some other is more beautiful, I believe, however, respectfully, that if they attend more diligently to the whole and the parts, they will quickly retract this opinion. Where indeed, I ask, would they find two towers of such magnificence and perfection, so high, so large, so strong, clothed around about with such multiple varieties of ornaments? Where, I ask, would they find such a multipartite arrangement of so many lateral vaults above and below? Where, I ask, would they find such light-filled amenities as the many surrounding chapels? Furthermore, let them tell me in what church I may see such a large cross, of which one arm separates the choir from the nave. Finally, I would willingly learn, were two such circles situated opposite each other in a straight line, which on account of their appearance are given the name of the fourth vowel, among which smaller orbs and circles with wondrous artifice so that some arrange circularly, others angularly, surround windows, ruddy with precious colors, and beautiful with the most subtle figures of the pictures. In fact, I believe that this church offers the carefully discerning such cause for admiration that its inspection can scarcely sate the soul." And so the cathedral remained for the next 500 years, a monument to the grandeur and beauty of God, witnessing important coronations, funerals, civic and religious celebrations, its cultural and religious tapestry growing richer by the contribution of French culture around it, decade after decade. All of this came to an abrupt end when the winds of revolution swept over the country. The end of 1793 marked the beginning of radical, violent de-Christianization as the leaders of the revolution made it their goal to eradicate religion from public life. The government seized church property, clergy were stripped of their power and compelled to take an oath of allegiance to the state. Mass was outlawed in Paris and wouldn't resume for 2 years. Armed mobs went throughout France, desecrating churches to rid them of their statues and crosses. Notre Dame was no exception. Vandals destroyed many of its treasures. The 28 statues of the biblical kings which adorned its facade were decapitated, as the revolutionaries confused them with French kings in their lustful pursuit to destroy all French institutions. No large statue escaped destruction, save the statue of Our Lady on the portal of the cloister. That same year, Notre Dame, that noble and sacred place, was rededicated to the cult of reason, an attempt to promote an atheistic state-sponsored religion, a religion of man where the only God was the people. Liberty, truth, and reason were to rule the day and lift humanity out of the dark ages represented by the church. The rededicated cathedral hosted the Festival of Reason, its high altar replaced with an altar to liberty upon which a flame burned, symbolizing truth. The statues of the Virgin Mary replaced with effigies of the Goddess of Liberty, and over its main portal were inscribed the words, "To Philosophy." Women dressed in white Roman garb and the tricolor sash paraded around impersonating the Goddess of Reason, who in turn represented liberty. Despite their best attempts to the contrary, the cult of reason was fleeting. Within a year, it had been outlawed and replaced with the cult of the Supreme Being, the brainchild of Robespierre, a cult that ultimately died with him. The revolutionary age left Notre Dame defaced, stripped of its voice, violated, but the truth for which it stood remained. Nothing could take away the unmatched witness to Christ and his church that this majestic cathedral represented. In 1801, Napoleon Bonaparte restored Notre Dame to the Catholic Church. The cathedral was renovated, its exterior whitewashed in preparation for the infamous crowning of Napoleon as Emperor of the French in 1804. After which, the cathedral enjoyed a small respite from the previous tumult, but the damage brought on by the recklessness of the French Revolution was done. By the time young Augustus Pugin and his father came upon the cathedral in 1827, it was a building entirely emaciated, devoid of its wonderful sculptures and spires. Nonetheless, Pugin collapsed when he first saw it. He was overwhelmed by the intensity of his feelings and the stress of having to sketch it. Notre Dame de Paris left a lasting impression on Pugin. Its design inspired and guided him as he went on to become one of the most influential Gothic architects in England. The beginning of the 19th century brought new challenges for Notre Dame. Gothic architecture, which once was the crown jewel of French culture, had given way to the Renaissance. Parisians saw the Gothic, dark and richly decorated spaces as vulgar, offensive structures that represented the past. Greek and Roman motifs adorned the new buildings of Paris, and increasingly, great Gothic structures were being demolished throughout the country. By 1829, Notre Dame itself had reached a dangerous state of disrepair. Officials in Paris were in discussion about demolishing the building. Its largest stones were earmarked for new bridge construction. The decades of abuse, the fact that it served as a munition warehouse during the French Revolution, and the lack of attention during the Napoleonic Wars had taken its toll. Notre Dame was to be no more. The artistic and engineering marvel that dazzled the world for nearly 500 years seemed to matter little to the indifferent Parisians, eager to turn the page of history. But not all were indifferent. A young man of 27, by the name of Victor Hugo, already an accomplished author and playwright, was a prominent voice in the rising movement to save the Gothic monuments of France. In his essay, War on the Demolishers, he decries the foolishness of a people who would willingly destroy their identity. He wrote, All manner of profanation, degradation, and ruin are all at once threatening what little remains of these admirable monuments of the Middle Ages that bear the imprint of past national glory to which both the memory of kings and the tradition of the people are attached. While who knows what bastard edifices are being constructed at great cost, buildings that with the ridiculous pretension of being Greek or Roman in France are neither Roman nor Greek. Other admirable and original structures are falling without anyone caring to be informed, whereas their only crime is that of being French by origin, by history, and by purpose. A universal cry must finally go up to call the new France to the aid of the old. His efforts didn't stop there. Victor Hugo had a great admiration for that noblest of French cathedrals. A gigantic book in stone, he called it. Built poetry that represented the pinnacle of architecture. As he saw it, Notre Dame marked the end of an age, the end of the age of architecture, in which the artists of the Middle Ages found the greatest freedom of expression in the stone of a cathedral. In the new age of the printing press, the building would give way to the written word. In his words, the book would kill the cathedral. Thus he would write a book to try to capture the grandeur of Notre Dame, to capture the imagination of others and help them to see the old building as the last great flowering of architecture, just as he saw it. Notre Dame de Paris was published in 1831 to great acclaim, and the book was read by people throughout the country. People fell in love with the building, which Hugo described in lengthy, rich detail. And so people began coming from all over France to catch a glimpse of Notre Dame. What they found was a building that was falling apart, and public outrage over its state quickly reached the king, who ordered that the cathedral be restored in 1844. The daunting task of restoring Notre Dame was given to the duo of Jean-Baptiste Lassus and Eugène Viollet-le-Duc, as they had recently proven themselves capable while restoring the nearby Sainte-Chapelle. Work began in 1844. It was a massive undertaking that was closely scrutinized by the public, and to make matters worse, Jean-Baptiste Lassus died shortly after the project began, leaving the young Leduc as the sole responsible architect on the project. The Duke led an army of sculptors, artisans, glassmakers, masons, and craftsmen through drawings and engravings, charting a course to bring Notre Dame back to its former glory. Le Duc was meticulous and traveled around France documenting and studying how to make Notre Dame whole again. His methods were not without criticism, however, because for all of his scholarly rigor, Le Duc would also take considerable liberties in how he interpreted the restoration, oftentimes embellishing the building with elements from his own imagination, but that he saw as in the spirit of the original design. The best example of this is in the significantly taller and more ornate spire that he designed to replace the spire which was removed in 1786 and which was lost in the recent Holy Week fire of 2019. Despite the criticism, it is difficult to overstate the importance of Le Duc's work in the recovery of Notre Dame. The restoration of the Gallery of the Kings, the spires along the nave, the wonderful entry portals, and even the gigantic stained glass rose windows were all restored under his supervision. His dedication, his scholarly attention to detail, and yes, even his inventiveness would lead him to restore other great French buildings, and would become a model for many architects who would take on the work of restoration throughout the rest of Europe. And so the cathedral was saved. It would go on to survive two great world wars and the upheaval that came afterward. In 1963, Notre Dame celebrated its 800th anniversary. It received a cleaning that restored the stone to its original off-white color. But the work of maintaining this great edifice never stops. This mirrors our lives, our faith, and our culture. How quickly we forget what is important, how easily we go off chasing the latest trends. What many people may not know is that Notre Dame was once again in need of major repair. Pollution, deferred maintenance, and the weight of time meant that the cathedral was once again crumbling. This episode was meant to be another call to arms, a call to come to the rescue of Notre Dame, a call for a new Victor Hugo, or better yet, an army of Victor Hugos. But then came the Holy Week fire, and nothing was the same. It was heart-wrenching to watch this noble, beautiful building that has been through so much up in flames and in such grave danger of collapsing. Thanks be to God it was spared, and with many of its treasures intact. Now all we can think about is its restoration, which is great. But let us not forget that we were letting it die a slow and quiet death just a few days before. Like the Parisians of the early 19th century, we took it for granted and passively consented to its demise. Let this fire serve as a reminder that architecture matters, that culture is not automatic, and that indifference can be an incredibly destructive force. May we learn to be vigilant and give proper value to the treasures that are these cathedrals and churches, an unmatched testament to the faith of our forefathers and to the glory and honor of God. Thanks for listening. The best way to enjoy the podcast is to pull up the accompanying blog post for the episode at beautyevernew.com. There you will find show notes, guest information, helpful visual aids, and more. To continue the conversation, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and let us know how you're experiencing beauty in your churches and communities.